Hello again, and welcome to the B-side for Titus 1. We've got a few clips from Peyton's intro and from Chapter 1 that didn't quite fit the time, but really fascinating content. I know I was intrigued. See, Titus comes up all over the New Testament, but I never did piece together his storyline until Peyton laid it all out for me. So we recorded that for you, along with some other great insights on the letter and on Chapter 1. The elements here were edited, so you'll hear a short pause between each one, and I hope you enjoy. Take it away, Peyton.
I want you to imagine that the Apostle Paul looked at you on the city streets of downtown New York City and told you, all right, the Big Apple's yours. Establish churches in every major neighborhood. And when you're done, come and meet me. You probably feel scared. You'd probably be out of your depth. But one thing is for certain, if Paul trusted Titus with this kind of responsibility, Titus must have been a stud, and a stud he was. Gathering from all the places where Titus is mentioned in the New Testament and piecing it together, we can make up a mosaic and get a clear picture of just who this assistant to Paul was. One thing is true, he was fearless. Timothy had the first two of the pastoral epistles addressed to him. Now Titus gets the third and final pastoral epistle. And one thing we know that's true of Timothy is that he struggled with being brave and courageous. Titus, on the other hand, he didn't give a rip about what others thought. Unlike Timothy, who became circumcised to reduce any problems he may face from the circumcision group, Titus simply refused to be circumcised. His attitude was like, hey, bring it on. Titus was saved on Paul's first missionary journey, and he traveled with Paul to the Jerusalem Council as a specimen, a live specimen, giving proof to Paul's claim that the Gentiles could come to Jesus without being circumcised. You can read more about this in Galatians chapter 2, verse 1 through 4. In fact, what stands out about Titus is his zeal for mission and seeing others come to faith was so important to him that he zips all around the map of the New Testament. In fact, in 2 Corinthians 8:16, Paul says that Titus went with much enthusiasm and on his own initiative to visit them. The irony is that he probably ran circles around those who stated that he couldn't be saved because he hadn't been circumcised. Here the circumcision group claim he couldn't be a Christian, and yet he was making more Christians than any of them. It seems everywhere you look to trace missions in the New Testament, Titus turns up somewhere. On Paul's second missionary journey, Titus was sent to lead the Corinthians for a time. He actually hand-delivered the letter we know as 2 Corinthians to the church there. On the third missionary journey of Paul, Titus was so valuable that when Titus didn't show up due to some unknown delay, Paul actually changed his travel plans and his itinerary and went to Macedonia instead. That is a big deal. When Paul finally camped out in Ephesus to train church planters for 3 years, guess who was there? Titus helped Paul train church planters. And at the end of his third missionary journey, Paul was in prison and shipped to Rome. Titus was his travel companion even on that journey. And it was at the harbor that Paul looked at Titus and said, hey, I need you to stay here and continue the work. It's a good thing that Titus listened this time, because Paul's infamous shipwreck occurred after leaving the port in Crete. When Paul was awaiting judgment during his final imprisonment in Rome, you guessed it, Titus was right there. After having finished up on Crete, he joins Paul, but Paul tells Timothy in 2 Timothy 4:10 that he didn't stay there long because he sent him there to the mission field again, this time to Dalmatia, what we now know as Yugoslavia, Serbia, and Montenegro. The letter of Titus would have actually been written after Paul's release from prison in Rome that we read about in the book of Acts. You could say that it actually probably takes place after the book of Acts stops. Titus 4:12 indicates that Paul was a free man again. He says, when I send Artemis to you, or Tychicus, be diligent to come to me at Nicopolis, for I have decided to spend the winter there. Send Zenas the lawyer and Apollos on their journey with haste, that they may lack nothing. I don't know about you, but most prisoners don't get to plan where they're going to spend the winter.
Now, one challenge here is exactly what is the role of the elder or the overseer we see here in verses 6 and 7. They focus on the requirements, but I know back in Timothy, we saw deacons, we saw bishops. It really depends on what translation you have. So what's the role of these people?
So an elder would be someone who governs and really teaches. That's one of the qualifications. They're able to teach in Timothy. But the elders are synonymous with leaders. You could have an evangelist. You could have a shepherd. You could have a teacher. Those different roles in Ephesians chapter 4 that he lays out. But a deacon, we first see the deacons popping up in the book of Acts after they had a mass influx of people, and there were just needs in the body. People needed to be served. Therefore, the word deacon literally means servant. And they don't govern at all like the elders do, but it's kind of like you have two different roles of leadership, one serving, one leading.
And both, of course, are serving. Leadership is an act of service, but it's in a role. As people have needs, disputes, stuff comes up, they turn to the elders. And so Titus is setting those elders in place so that the church can function. And they've got to have a certain standard of character.
And that's the key. Notice that the chief difference between what was experienced in society and what Paul did in appointing elders was in society, it had to be an older person. And the early church actually appointed young men like Timothy as elders, completely turning that model on its head. Character indeed was the only requirement.
All right, time to jump topics here to verse 10 and Paul's warning against the idle talkers and false teachers. You may wonder why it is that the Christian church always seems to attract deceivers, false teachers, and the like. So with some thoughts on that, the following was edited out of our conversation about verses 10 to the end of chapter 1. You know, I think what's happening is as the gospel was sweeping through Crete, a lot of people were turning to it, and when people are turning to something, you get greed comes in as well, because when greedy people see people flocking to something, they see money moving that way. And what was happening on Crete is that you've got believers coming, but along with them, you've got people who never really believed the message, but they're drawn to the crowd as an opportunity. They're coming in with their own message. And Paul is telling Titus, you've got to get leadership who believes the message, who holds firmly to it, and who live it out. And he's warning against these guys who he calls, in the NIV in verse 10, it actually calls them the circumcision group. These guys were driven by dishonest gain. They were greedy for it, and it was drawing them in.
Absolutely. In verse 10, he says, "For there are many who are insubordinate, empty talkers, and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision party." Notice that he says they're empty talkers. They don't do anything. There's no life change. And they're deceivers, they're liars, they're true to form for all that live on Crete. They must be silenced, since they are upsetting whole families by teaching, for shameful gain, what they ought not to teach. Remember, they were known to be a little bit greedy on this island. Therefore, he says, rebuke them, in verse 13, sharply, that they may be sound in the faith, not devoting themselves to Jewish myths and the commands of people who turn away from the truth. To the pure, all things are pure, but to the defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But both their minds and their consciences are defiled. They profess to know God, but they deny him by their works. They are detestable, disobedient, unfit for any good work. What you'll notice in this book is the contrast. You see here that they're detestable, disobedient, and unfit for any good work. But remember Paul's exhortation at the end of the letter? Verse 14 of chapter 3 says, "And let our people learn to devote themselves to good works, so as to help cases of urgent need and to not be unfruitful." That is the exact antithesis of what he's laid down here. Unfit for any good work and people who aren't fruitless. He wants to see the situation turned around, and he knows that only the gospel can accomplish that. Therefore, when Paul talks at the end of chapter 1, he says they profess to know God, but they deny him by their works. There again, we see Paul's connection between the gospel, as he mentions in chapter 1, their knowledge of the truth, which accords with godliness. You see, if you don't have a changed life, like we said earlier, you don't know diddly. Paul is worried that these idle talkers who need to be silenced were going to do what one man said we can do so easily in the Western world, which is manufacture atheists with mundane Christianity. Paul doesn't want people to hear a false gospel or see a bad witness and make up their mind about Jesus. An entire island full of thousands of people was hanging in the balance, and what Paul wanted to do was establish life-changed people who could change the lives of others and set ablaze the spark that would change an island-wide transformation. One of the other contrasts that you'll see with Paul is he talks in the beginning about being dominated. These guys on the Isle of Crete weren't dominated by anything except their own passions, their own laziness, and gluttony. Like I said at the beginning, we're all dominated by something. What about you? Are you dominated by the grace of God? Has the grace of God that appears in the gospel, has it come and dominated you yet? Because once that dominates your heart, it changes everything else.
And that's it for the B-side to Titus 1. Thanks for tuning in. And while I've got the mic, I want to give a plug for Peyton and his awesome ministry. Peyton is one of my favorite Bible teachers and the best teacher I know on the subject of church planting. He has two books, Church Zero and Reaching the Unreached. He also has a podcast, the Church Planter Podcast, all outstanding stuff. He's also one of my best friends and, given the opportunity, a complete goofball. You can find all of Peyton's stuff on his website at peytonjones.ninja. Why dot ninja? Find out at peytonjones.ninja. And Peyton and I will both be back for our next chapter of Titus.